Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Leah Weiss. Leah is a researcher, professor, consultant, and author. She teaches courses on compassionate leadership at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and is the principal teacher and founding faculty for Stanford's Compassion Cultivation Program, conceived by the Dalai Lama. She also directs compassion education and scholarship at Hope Lab, an Omdiar group research and development nonprofit focused on resilience. Her new book is called How We Work, Live Your Purpose, Reclaim Your Sanity, and Embrace the Daily Grind. Leah Weiss, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So when I talk about how Second City takes its improvisational pedagogy into the workplace, I often say that improvisation is yoga for your social skills, or I say it's noisy group mindfulness. And in the introduction to your book, you write that, quote, "I like the phrase work as meditation because it has this paradigm shift built into it. It doesn't make any sense by the narrow definition of meditation as sitting and doing nothing." So I wonder if we're kind of talking about the similar things.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to dig into that. I'd love to hear more what you, how you frame the interpersonal process and how you think about that.
Yeah, so let me throw it out at you and see if it sticks or makes any sense. So a lot of, I mean, essentially with improvisation, you recognize that it's an act of groups of people making something out of nothing, and we have many sort of nudges or, you know, rules of the road when you take the training, and it almost all begins with focus and in fact being others focused. So you sort of have to learn this not getting ahead of yourself because you have to listen to everything someone is giving you, so you can't pre-plan it in your head. So you have to sort of allow yourself to risk just listening and hearing and noticing, sort of supreme noticing. That's one of the first things. And then you learn how to sort of shift your focus in terms of your response. There's more to it, but I think there's maybe elements of that connect to the work that you talk about.
Absolutely. I think this capacity for paying attention and for learning to be undistracted and to recognize that we can let our scripts and our plans go and actually not only be okay, but thrive in that environment. And maybe the one nuance that stands out at me to add is when we work with interpersonal mindfulness, I pay a lot of attention to the titrating of our attention mm-hmm. between what's going on in the person, the room, and also my own physiological, emotional, mental reaction to it.
Right. That makes perfect sense. And I thought it was interesting, too, because you also say, quote, "the term meditation comes with too much baggage." And I imagine this comes from working in a business school where you know, sort of corporate people might be scared off by that idea. And you seem to make a very sort of you have science and data to back up your findings, but you also seem to understand that you're not going to get maybe the response you want to get if you use sort of the pure meditation terms.
I think it's in part an issue of semantics, and I also think that meditation itself is limited. It's a way of training ourselves to be present in all kinds of situations, in work and beyond. Mm-hmm. But when we only talk about meditation, that's a very specific activity. When we talk about mindfulness, Now that can carry into anything.
Yeah, I totally appreciate that distinction. I was also really intrigued in the book, and this is early, where you connect design thinking with the 2,000-year-old Tibetan system called Dampa Sum, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. So that idea, and you stated it means good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. And there's something very simplistic about that, but also kind of lovely. And it speaks very much to my understanding of how you can be successful in work when you sort of consider the entire process.
Yes, I think the notion of having a process that we're applying to our own mental growth is an important one, because otherwise it's too easy for people to import levels of expectation on themselves that either they meet them or they've failed, and then they can't be mindful, or this isn't something that's for them. So I think having this whole process to view the learning of mindfulness, of compassion, of purpose as a growth mindset, as something that we are setting intentions in, we're experimenting with, and then we're reflecting on, and the reflections will filter back in to the next round of intentions, experiments, and reflections. And it's very similar to the process of learning about a context, prototyping a solution, getting feedback, and iterating from there. So that's why I draw the connection with design thinking.
Yeah, which is also the connection to improvisation, because we do a lot of work with IDEO, and we've co-taught, and we have a very similar process where we create our shows in front of an audience. We get that feedback real time. We do a note session afterwards with the director and sort of reflect on things to then adjust again in front of the audience. And that reflection, I thought the whole sort of idea of focusing on reflecting was really interesting to me, because I think in many ways when people think of reflection, they might think of it passively, and that's absolutely not, I think, how you're talking about it here, right?
Correct. And it's not the way that anybody who's working in a design process would be talking about it. I just did some work at the D school, or the design school at Stanford, overseeing student projects this last quarter. And to talk about the reflection piece it in their work, if you skip over reflection, then there's no opportunity to learn lessons. So when people talk about learn from failure or fail fast, that only works if you pause and draw out the learnings. And this is something that people have been talking about for hundreds of years, by the way. I mean, of course, for thousands in the context of Buddhism. But now I'm thinking about John Dewey, whose work in pioneering in the education context was that we're having experiences all the time. So we can't say experience equals education. The hallmark of actually learning is this process of reflection that we do interpersonally, and we do in the context of a proximal of a learning environment where we can share our observations, get feedback, and do that with an educator and other learners.
And you talk about later in the book, so there's a chapter in my book, Yes And, which talks about failure, because we're a very failure-positive organization, and a lot of people talk about sort of failing forward or failing better. And what I sensed from the book was that this idea of reflection might more accurately speak to what we're talking about, because we're not just about failing. It actually isn't about that, but it's about sort of using those failures as part of our broader reflection process. Am I getting that right?
Yes. I mean, I think there's a few things at play in the way that I talk about failure. One is that we need to be honest with ourselves, and I see this in my MBA students and the work I do with organizations, that even if the organization is valuing innovation and they say they want to learn from failure, that doesn't in itself overcome the obstacles that individuals and teams experience. It feels uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And people need to learn how to deal with that experience emotionally, especially when many of us are in the habit of learning whenever we find ourselves in that uncomfortable situation where something's gone wrong, we're in the habit of attributing blame, and it becomes a reflex. So this is really actually revolutionary in calling for people to feel that discomfort, but not move away from it, and in fact be able to move back in and through it towards the lessons learned. And that's where the success can emerge from the failure.
Yeah. So in our work, we have adages like make mistakes work for you. See all obstacles as gifts. There's a great phrase that the teacher Rick Thomas has, which he says you need to fall into the crack in the game. And this is when a mistake happens on stage. And he's like, no, drive into it because that's where all the good stuff is. And we find that over and over. Like my experience in 30 years at working in Second City is the best scenes and some of the best improvised moments were born out of like that wasn't supposed to happen. And I think that's actually generally true if you think of a lot of innovations and successes that have happened across a variety of fields, that they weren't the intended result often. They were something kind of went awry and people went with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that requires the tolerance for learning how to be in that in-between space, which I think both of our work is really focused on giving people those tools to be able to do that so that they can have the innovation instead of there's lots of people who make mistakes and don't have innovation or advances as a result. And there's some outstanding people who do, and this is part who do have the positive outcome from the unintended event. And I think the differentiator, and this is what I am really suggesting to my students, becomes a differentiator in their work. Your ability to have mental game that you know yourself, you know what your responses will be, you know even your negative patterning, so you can recognize it and not fall into it and do something different this time, is the name of the game.
Hard. I mean, this is the other thing. It's hard, and it doesn't just happen because someone you read it in a book or someone tells you. You have to form some level of practice to keep yourself in that shape. It's like a muscle, right? We notice this too. When people stop improvising for a period of time, they get really rusty. A lot of the alumni, when they come back, are a little like, I don't know if I want to do this because I'm not going to be as strong. Because they certainly recognize that when you're in the sort of heat of the program and at Second City, it's like it really is. Most people stay there for 4 years. It's very much like a graduate or a college program or something, and they're doing it constantly. And so when they're leaving, they are in such good sort of cognitive shape to encounter others, and they're practicing divergent thinking. They're inventing constantly. And you write in the book too, many business school graduates have mastery of the technical skills needed to land a job, but they seem to lack critical thinking skills. This is the like soft skills are hard to teach part, right?
Yes. And it's not just my observation. This is research that we're pulling from hiring managers and executives, that the perception is that, 90% of executives interviewed on the topic will say that it's harder to find the soft skills, mm-hmm. and that they're just as, if not more important. And this becomes the bottleneck for people's careers. They can get hired into a job, but then they hit a ceiling because they don't have the leadership skills. They don't have the people skills. They don't have the ability to do the things we're talking about with failure. This becomes the key that, and frankly, I think it's even more of an issue now because technical skills are getting updated quickly.
Yep.
So you talk to, my students, and many of them have engineering backgrounds, or they even in the context of finance or product work, things are changing so rapidly. They know that whatever the skill set is today, they're going to have to completely update it within a matter of a few years at the latest. So what they need to focus on while they're in school, it would be a bad use of a lot of money and time to spend an MBA program just only working on technical skills, since they're going to be obsolete anyways, to learn the people skills. That's the investment that they see as more valuable. And I think that this is translating into workplaces, and it seems like you're well experienced in that phenomenon as well.
I was at a learning conference yesterday. I was on this panel, and someone kind of brought up this topic, and someone goes, no one ever closed a big deal by email. And I had to think back. I'm like, I have never closed a big deal by email. Like, every big deal was in person, building a relationship, back and forth. You might might have gotten the final, you know, yes by that, but usually not even with that. It's usually at least a phone call, but usually in person. And I want to dig a little bit into some of these specific areas because I think they're kind of interesting and people will maybe get it more. You talk about embodiment. And this is a really rich area. And I'd love to sort of unpack it a bit, how you see it playing out, this understanding of embodiment within a sort of work environment.
Yeah, so I think one of the key things is we need to look at what our existing attitude is towards our body while we're working. And for many people, it's either ignoring the body or viewing it almost as an imposition that mm-hmm. I have to feed it, I have to, you know, deal with discomfort in my desk chair or figuring out my ergonomics. And we get into a mode of just working and not recognizing we're in a body while we're doing the work. It's like we're brains in a jar. Mm-hmm. So that may seem fine and ideal in some sense, but actually what we're missing out on is a huge amount of information. And for me, a real aha in terms of how to present this fact, I think it's embedded in mindfulness practices, no doubt. But for me, the aha came when I was reading Kahneman's book,
yep.
The Nobel Laureate, and he talks about intuition is recognition. And when he digs in, it's recognition of the patterns in the body. And he gives the example of the fire chief who runs into the building during a fire, recognizes he needs to clear it. They get everybody out in the building, burst in the flames, and he's being interviewed afterwards. And they say, how did you know? And nobody else in there caught that. When he described his experience, it was he felt a particular set of sensations on his ears, on the top of his ears. And he was such a veteran that he understood that that was his body's quote-unquote poker tell. That's my language, not Kahneman's. That this was all off, and he knew to read that, and he acted accordingly. So that's like, you know, a dramatic example, but you see this in investors and designers,
right?
All kinds of professions where people have this recognition of their somatic experience that is important information, particularly once they've done the 10,000 hours of training and they really know their field. It becomes a shortcut that you can train for. And so that's how I motivate my students. Like, you're building this expertise. Why not leverage the information in your body and also build your recognition of this kind of shortcut for yourself?
There was I got an email this morning. No, it was on LinkedIn. A former podcast guest who said, I thought you'd be interested in this. And it was an art museum in Toledo that was doing training for people who are safety workers. And what they were offering was they were teaching them how to appreciate and understand a painting as a way for them to notice better. In situations where there might be safety problems. And I took a moment. I'm like, that's really smart. Because the way you notice art is a very different. I mean, you have a whole, you have to sort of, to understand it, look at it differently. And I know my reaction in terms of certain kinds of art. I feel it in my body differently, especially when I'm exposed to sort of great art or disturbing art. And you sort of have this response. And I found that really unique.
Yes, yes. I love the application with safety. I think that's,
right.
That's such an important application. And the examples I was giving before weren't including something like, you know, for a physician or a nurse, the quality of attention that you're paying to a patient. I just had one of the largest oil companies in the world is interested in looking at how can we use mindfulness as a way to really train through the use of the body employees to recognize these the situations that are more loaded with danger. And I was like, that is so forward thinking, and it makes a ton of sense.
But this is the thing, though. Like, this is where we're finding the business going as well, because we're now brought in ethics and compliance, in risk and harassment, in diversity and inclusion. And you know, 5 years ago, these conversations are not happening. Like, we could have had all the marketing materials in the world, and no one would have approached Second City for this. But I think the evidence and literature is catching up with regard to, all right, how do we keep people inside difficult conversations, and how do we create environments and ensembles that will promote ethical behavior? Because clearly, you know, you're not going to get someone to be ethical by telling them to be ethical. You know, you have to design scenarios and promote pro-social behaviors and all this stuff. And it's funny that it's not funny, it's actually smart, but the fact that they are going to the soft skills to solve the hardest problems.
Yeah. Well, and I think it makes so much sense. I was interviewing John Levin, who's a dean of the Stanford Graduate School of Business, mm-hmm. and was talking to him about ethics and the overlap with the work that I do, but more generally, you know, the approach to ethics. And he made such an important point that's related to what you're saying, that, you know, when we're in the workplace, we're not in a situation where it's clearly announced this is an ethical moment.
Right.
And I think that when we talk to people who are in environments that they felt like their ethical or moral compass slipped, it happens subtly over time. And I think that's part of why this embodiment piece is so important, because it's recognizing the slippage, recognizing the discomfort. And this relates directly to, you know, the incredible set of research on moral injury and how we learn when we get accustomed in the context of our work and our roles to types of pain or ethical deviation we need to participate in, that we recalibrate, but that this causes real confusion over time and real pain over time. So I can imagine that the kind of work that you're doing, or these trainings and embodiment that are teaching people real time to recognize their experience when these moments of that can seem subtle but then stack up,
right,
are happening.
Yeah, someone once said to me, the only thing I've regretted are my acts of unkindness, which really resonated with me. And in a work, when I think about that in a work sense, it's exactly this stuff. It's when, damn it, I knew better. Like, everything about this was telling me that it was either going to end up in an unethical situation, or I was not being true to someone, or whatever it was. And those are the ones that stick with me, not all the other stuff. And I never sort of think about all the successes. I'm never like, oh, I'm just going to think about everything great I did. I always land on the things that I did wrong and wasn't able to sort of control in the moment. But I think for most of us, we know that, and you have a great phrase, you say feeling can begin in the gut, and the gut and the brain communicate in both directions, brain to gut, but also gut to brain. And I don't think we think about it like that, but that's very true. It goes back and forth.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. It's really struck me that, and I'm curious your experience of this, in the teaching of this kind of content, like, mm-hmm. there seems to be so many different ways that people are wired when we move through the world. Like, some people, when we introduce the idea of an embodiment, or what are you feeling physically, what are you feeling emotionally, they're clear. For other people, it actually is they're stumped. There's just no answer to that. It takes some real learning and practice to be able to know what's being felt physically, emotionally, and then to be able to do that real time and be able to behave in a way that draws on awareness of that. I'm curious if you see this kind of range too.
My sense of things, so I've been at Second City for 30 years, and my sense of all of this is there is a pretty big slice of the population that needs to unlearn. And this is, you know, Kahneman's got the stuff too in there. But, you know, and I think it's a variety of things. It's families that were emotionally cut off. It is the sort of rigid educational structures where, you know, you tested and you got right on the test and you're good to go. And then you find out you come into the real world and no one's providing these kinds of tests. And people essentially never had time to sort of practice being a human being. And this is why I think on the one hand, for like theater majors and sometimes for like sports people too, they've had a fair amount of practice in sort of interacting as human beings in groups. And increasingly now, when, you know, people, whether they're homeschooled or they're learning through the computer and they're texting all day and they're sort of in this digital void, that they're really cut off. And so it's almost like you have to sort of reteach them how to encounter other human beings in the world. So that's always been there. It was there before social media, but I think it's been sort of supersized in the last decade or so.
Yeah, that is really interesting to hear your perspective on it, because I feel similarly, and then I'll also then wonder, when comparing generationally, what are the implications, you know, when people have been raised as digital natives and with the technology, training themselves to have their attention pulled away all the time, which could be the opportunity to then learn to train their attention and ultimately have a better command of
right.
how it works. But I don't mean to be like a Luddite or pessimist about the technology, but I do think that, what are your observations over time? Do you see, is it technology or the roles that people are in thought work, or how do you do that?
I mean, you know, I've worked enough with academics, especially the work we do with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth, they make me be way more careful than I would normally be as a sort of Second City improv guy. But we're riffing, so it's fine. Certainly technology. So that's definitely one thing. But I will tell you, my 20-year-old son, who is fully wired, listens to long form podcasts. He's also improvised his whole life. So he's very engaged in the world and connected to it. And I'm very happy about where he's going. My 15-year-old daughter, and I've talked about this in the podcast before, has friends who will only fight via text, which is maybe the scariest thing I've ever heard in my life. So technology is absolutely one thing, but I also feel that there's a lack of connectedness that I see as a major issue in humanity. And again, this has also been a theme in the podcast with various guests, that it used to be sort of mortality was the one, you know, problem with humanity, and now it might mm-hmm. be isolation. And my wife is an academic, and she's been in situations where you've had a kid who's maybe he's on the spectrum, maybe there's other issues, and he says the wrong thing or sends someone the wrong, you know, image. And she's like, I just saw a troll created. You know, this person's getting kicked out of college or whatever. And she's like, they could have been saved. And I just saw a troll created. Mm. And that's something, I don't know if you've come across that, but it is, I can't get it out of my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. A lot of my observations, you know, just a very simple one, like working in the classroom at the business school, you know, I've seen the patterns of what we articulate for what's expected. You know, in the beginning, there weren't a lot of rules around technology. And now mm-hmm. it's part of when you're setting up your classroom, you clarify your expectations about how technology will be used.
Yep.
And I'm very clear, and I don't have computers or phones unless someone really needs it for their learning style, and then we talk about it. And I'll also, like early on in the quarter, talk about, hey, this is a class on mindful and compassionate leadership. So it's an extra great opportunity to just recognize when there's pulls to check your text in the middle of class or check mm-hmm. out in some way what's going on within yourself, as opposed to, you know, just get caught up in the distraction. And even so, there'll always be these, you know, moments in time where – people just can't help themselves.
Yeah.
And it becomes such an interest. And I get it. I mean, I definitely experience this pull, and we have a lot of conversations about it. So I guess what my feeling is at this point is just own the decisions,
mm-hmm.
Be aware of them as much as possible. And, and also to, like, I think the social reinforcement, because these behaviors are so compulsive for some people, it's helpful to recalibrate social norms where, you know, if my husband's got a phone out at dinner, I'm going to say something. If my student has it out, I'm going to say something. And
yeah.
then I also would like that to be reciprocated. And
yeah.
it's not from I'm better than you. It's we're all working with this, and I feel like you're not paying attention to me. When you're fubbing me or whatever.
Yeah, Adam Alter had that terrific book, who's the Stern School of Business, called Irresistible, which is all about digital addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you said something earlier, which I think points to a hope, which is, yes, this stuff is drawing our attention. There's the ludic loop stuff. It's not good. A lot of it's not good. However, perhaps we need that to reclaim our true focus. So my friend Neil Stevenson always makes this joke, which is like, you know, if someone were walking around with a hip flask in their front pocket, you'd be like, what are you doing? Like, but that was common. And he says that mm-hmm. his iPhone is the modern hip flask. We're going to be in in 5 or 10 years, people are going to be like, what are you doing wearing that thing? So this idea about wearable tech might be like the worst thing ever. In some regards, I think things, but we've seen even Fitbit go awry. But, so there might be a way of having wearable tech that is very different than what we have today. But I think the act of reclaiming the focus, and this is in your reflection part of this, right? So we're testing out the stuff. We've got all this media. We've got social stuff. We've got our iPhones. We're testing it out. Oh, wait, we discovered there's a lot of really unhealthy stuff. So let's work on finding seatbelts for our social media or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I like to be. My glass is pretty full. I'm certainly not a glass half empty guy, and I tend to think that your work leads you to be that as well and find
yeah.
some hope among this. So I don't know.
I do.
Yeah, yeah. There is so much I want. We're like totally running out of time here, and I have this like giant list of questions, which I got to none or very few of them. So before I ask you for your yes and story, we haven't talked enough about purpose, and there's so much stuff about purpose in the book, and I want to point one idea here, which I think is hugely important, because I think for a lot of people, they understand this idea of like, hey, you know, the generation coming up really needs to have purpose, but they get sort of caught up in like, oh my God, that has got to be this giant thing. And I love how you say, quote, it's not about a moral crusade, it's about the everyday. And there's so much of this book that points to that, is of having purpose in a moment and kind of knowing that there's a North Star for you. And you don't need to overcomplicate it, and it doesn't have to be, you know, some sort of giant endeavor. It can be as simple as like, I'm going to really be kind today, or I'm going to listen generously today, things like that. Am I summing up some of that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is maybe another place where our work dovetails, that we can view the day-to-day activities and interactions as the opportunity to get better at purposing of bringing it. And because it's really, I think, important to think of purpose as a verb and something that we touch in on repeatedly, and we have to view that as our zone of responsibility for ourselves. And if we're managing other people, that this is something we're taking seriously for them. And I think it has everything to do with whether our employees are engaged and passionate or not. It just is common sense. If we're not purposeful about our work, then of course we're half-assing it.
I love the purposing thing. And this is funny because when I go to do a keynote, I'm checking in on Facebook at the the airport where I'm going, and I will write keynoting. And then yesterday I had to be on a panel, and I haven't been on a panel in a while since I've been doing this, and I wrote panelisting, which is not, I mean, that is me, but it was very joyful for me to do. And I like how you're framing it, because I'm like, oh yeah, this is all, it's all part of the process. I'm not here because I am the keynote guy. I am here because I have a story to tell. I had a story before. I'm going to have a story now. I'm going to have a story later. And it's all related. And when we think about it in that sort of wider context, I find it very liberating, and I find it to be, it gets rid of my imposter syndrome, which frankly, I think we all have, that, you know, no, this is just part of the process of the conversation that I'm having with the world. That's where I happen to be right now. I have conversations with the world. So let's not make too much of, you know, this thing, because, you know, I like, and I've met very few people who are on the circuit who are like, oh no, I'm fully comfortable giving these speeches. Like I'm completely fine. And usually if they are, that's mean they're just doing the same thing over and over again. That's very rote.
Right. And then that doesn't pass the sniff test. People know that when they're getting the canned as opposed to...
Yes, they do. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm. All right. We're going to ask you for a yes and story. So every guest who comes in, we sort of say, you know, in improvisation, you can't say no. You can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. And I'm wondering if your work or your life, you have a time where you probably would have said no, but instead you said yes and. And what happened?
This is such a, I love this question. So the one that came to mind for me happened a couple weeks ago. We are relocated and our kids are in new schools, and there was an invitation many months ago to the first grade mom's weekend. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely, the timing was like right in the midst of my book launch. So for timing purposes and just also like going away with a bunch of people I didn't know well would have been a no for me. Mm-hmm. But I felt that no. And then I was like, I wonder what it would be like to say yes. And I talked about it with my sister-in-law, and she is a real introvert and really encouraged me to go. And I did go. And the outcome of it was I connected with such amazing women that I never would have known. In particular, there were a few moms who also work and have jobs, and so we're not the ones who are doing a lot of the volunteer work around the classroom in the day-to-day. And they were really important connections and people that I am, you know, I think will be relationships for years to come that never would have happened.
I love that story. And in part two, because you know, no is not a bad thing. In fact, like we have to learn to say no to more in the sense of not trying to, because multitasking is a myth, not doing too much, not taking on too many projects. But the yes ands, if you can really sort of focus the yes ands and being like new experiences, meeting new people, finding new connections, that stuff is almost always really rewarding in some way. And at worst, you get a funny story if it goes bad. And at best, you kind of opened yourself up to like a whole bunch of cool new opportunities that you never knew existed.
Yeah.
The book is called How We Work. I really recommend this. I went in skeptical because I don't know why, because I dig all of this stuff. I studied Buddhism and all that, but I think part of me is a self-check on this. And I really, the narrative is so smart, and the way of blending evidence-based science with work that's been done over you know, thousands and thousands of years. It's really important. These are good insights. Leah Weiss, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going down, 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 roll.